From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. The big auto show in Detroit is increasingly a consumer electronics show for the car. Automakers no longer simply introduce new models of cars and trucks. Now they're just as likely to roll out a new infotainment system or app. But NPR's Sonari Glinton reports that some of these new high-tech bells and whistles just aren't ready for prime time.
It used to be that when you talk to car executives, they were all about horsepower, styling, even fuel economy. Now it's all tech. Thomas Tetzlaff is with Volkswagen of Canada.
As we've seen in the automotive industry, the growth in mechanical changes has now become incremental, whereas the growth in the consumer electronics industry seems to be taking place at a rate that is, you know, almost unprecedented.
Tetzlaff says the average young driver doesn't want their car to be a rolling oasis. They want to be connected to social media like Facebook or Twitter.
We have realized that if we shut our customers out of that, they're going to shut us out of the equation. And the vehicles we're showing today, although we're touting the outsides and the engines, we're cognizant of the fact that we need to bring the technology to the dashboard, to the driver.
Almost all the car companies, including Volkswagen, are working with outside suppliers to bring consumer electronics to your dashboard. Cadillac, for instance, has what it calls Q, or Cadillac User Experience. This is the future. We're talking Jetsons. It has voice control, and it projects information right onto the windshield in front of you, anything from a text message to a map. It also has a flat screen on the center console that can interact with your smartphone, the radio, and the internet. Matt Heistrom helped design the Q system.
So the center console essentially has, there's an 8-inch touchscreen. So like your iPhone or your smartphone device, where you can swipe things, swipe to different screens, you're able to... Which didn't work right now. Jason, what did you do to this?
What did I do?
Is the swiping working on here?
Now, to be fair to the folks at Cadillac, that was not a working car, but an auto show demo. But that glitch on the flat screen gets to the heart of the problem with consumer electronics. They're prone to bugs, which can be a problem when you're driving 65 miles an hour.
I'm an engineer, and I hate to knock on engineers, but engineers want to give the system the capabilities of doing anything and everything that you can ever want to do.
David Champion is with Consumer Reports. He's been a critic of many car infotainment systems, especially ones using flat panel screens.
If you're working an iPad or an iPhone, you're actually looking down at the eye and your eyes are following where your hands are going. And that's your primary focus. So if you're putting a touch screen into a car, therefore your primary focus when operating that touch screen, your eyes have to be on the screen. And that's what makes it distracting.
Champion says that's why your car has knobs and buttons you can feel without seeing. Jeremy Anwell is with Edmunds.com.
The driving experience is so fundamentally different than, say, the desktop experience. And getting a bunch of guys in a room that used to, you know, write programs for Microsoft or whoever is probably not the right way to be thinking about this human-machine interface.
Anwell says companies like GM and Honda aren't Apple or Microsoft. Certainly not yet. Sonari Glinton, NPR News, Detroit.
The nation's law schools are facing growing pressure to be more upfront about their graduates' job prospects. Many former students say they were lured by juicy job numbers, but when they got out, all they ended up with was massive debt. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, the American Bar Association is cracking down, but too late for many.
Chloe Gilgan enrolled at New York Law School in 2005 with one thing in mind, getting a good-paying job. She says the school gave her every assurance that she was in the right place.
A high majority of their graduates would find employment at least within 9 months of graduating, and that they tended to have three-figure salaries.
3 years after graduation, Chloe Gilgan says the only three-figure number she's staring at is her student debt. The only job she found was doing work that did not require a law degree. Gilgan is convinced New York law twisted its job numbers.
Nobody can guarantee you'll have a job for sure, but what they can do is give you honest prospects.
So Chloe Gilgan has joined a proposed class action lawsuit against New York Law School, charging that it has deceived students. Attorney David Enziska is lining up plaintiffs who attended primarily lower-tier law schools, paid more than $40,000 a year, and feel they got little in return.
When you're taking out such staggering amount of debt, you want to make sure that you have a job at the end of the day, that you'll be able to pay back your loans and pay your bills.
New York Law School says it provides all the information required by the American Bar Association and more. Carol Buckler is interim dean. She says the school tries hard to counsel students about their employment prospects.
We also break down the information based on the type of employer and the salaries that graduates might expect.
But in blogs like The Law School Scam, former students howl about high tuition and lousy job prospects. And there's Kyle McEntee, who started lawschooltransparency.com. McEntee says he was outraged to find that the employment data supplied by many lower-tier schools is really part of a recruiting strategy.
And so a school might advertise a median salary of $160,000 and not disclose that only 10% of the class actually responded to the salary survey.
Or McEntee says schools don't disclose that some jobs are in fact funded by the law school. McEntee himself is a graduate of Vanderbilt Law, where he says he actually got good employment information when he enrolled. Elizabeth Workman, Assistant Dean for Career Services at Vanderbilt, says she keeps a close eye on students' achievement and their debt.
And if they will incur six figures in terms of debt, we have a very serious discussion about employment outcomes.
Activists say more schools need to follow that path. They blame the American Bar Association, which accredits law schools, for letting institutions decide what is accurate. The ABA's John O'Brien admits this has been a problem.
The definition of accurate has largely been left to the schools.
So recently, the ABA changed the rules. Starting next year, schools will have to report whether graduates are employed full-time, whether the positions graduates get require a law degree. That will help applicants in the future decide if they're picking a law school that is turning out employable lawyers. But John O'Brien says it's still up to students to scrutinize that data because the ABA can only demand transparency.
The schools are simply required to report. We do not have minimum standards for employment.
Kyle McEntee of lawschooltransparency.com says the ABA changes are a good first step, but they won't help students already in school. And these measures don't address larger issues. Why is law school enrollment continuing to rise when the job market is shrinking in many areas? The legal sector shed 1,800 jobs in December, according to the Labor Department. Kyle McEntee says the biggest challenge is battling a perception of invulnerability.
There's a culturally embedded view about law school, that it's this magic ticket to financial security. And as it turns out, this isn't the case, and it hasn't been the case for quite some time.
When critics attacked for-profit colleges for similar problems, the Department of Education tightened regulations on those schools, but the department says it has no authority to do the same to the vast majority of law programs. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Audie Cornish. It's been expected since December, and today it happened. A credit downgrade in Europe. Nine European countries were hit. Most notably, France lost its top AAA rating, and Italy was taken down two notches. The downgrades will likely make the task of solving Europe's debt crisis even harder. NPR's economics correspondent, John Itzi, joins us to sort through what happened. John, tell us, what are the other countries that were downgraded?
Well, first of all, we should say it was the credit rating agency Standard & Poor's that issued the downgrades. The other two big credit rating agencies, Fitch and Moody's, haven't followed suit. In addition to France being downgraded one notch and Italy by two notches, Austria also lost its AAA rating, and Spain was also downgraded two notches, as was Portugal. On the other hand, Germany and the Netherlands, along with Finland, retained their AAA ratings.
Now, the thing is, the S&P warned back in December that this might happen, so why are markets surprised?
Well, that's a good question. In some ways, I think S&P is simply confirming what the market has already told us. In fact, in past weeks, France and Italy were already paying higher interest rates to borrow money as if their credit rating had already been lowered. And there were no big changes in those rates today. Stock markets fell a bit in Europe and in the U.S., though only moderately today, less than 1%. So it would be easy to say this is formalizing what we already know. But I talked to Mohamed Alarian. He's the co-CEO of the big bond fund PIMCO, and he suggested we shouldn't be too complacent.
The easy thing to say is, no, we're not worse off. After all, S&P had signaled back in December. But there's a difference between signaling and doing something. And when you actually do something, you trigger second and third round effect.
John's second and third round effects, what might that be?
Well, for one thing, it might complicate the bailout mechanism the EU has put in place to handle problems like Greece. The EU Rescue Fund depends on the guarantees of EU countries, and France is the second biggest economy in Europe. It's been downgraded. That could complicate funds. That could complicate things for the fund as it tries to raise money. Countries like Japan might not lend unless they are paid a higher interest rate, or potential lenders might just change their mind and not participate in the emergency fund at all. Also, the downgrade affects contracts. Let's say you're a borrower and your contract with your lender requires you to have collateral of AAA bonds like France's old bonds. Well, now they're not AAA, so you're not living up to the contract. And there could also be political effects in Europe.
Political effects, especially for someone like maybe French President Nicolas Sarkozy.
Well, that's certainly a possibility, but there could also be broader effects in terms of relations within the European Union. Remember, Germany retains its AAA rating and France is diminished. Now, throughout the development of the European Union and the euro currency, France and Germany have been pretty much equal partners. But as one European analyst told me today, this action makes France less like Germany and more like Italy. So it could cement Germany's position in the driver's seat in Europe. France's finance minister tried to put the best face on it today. He said this is not a catastrophe. It's an excellent rating. That is the new AA-plus rating. But he acknowledged it's not good news.
NPR's economics correspondent, John Idsey. John, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Even though the S&P downgrade was widely anticipated, it's still a blow, especially in France, which is the second largest economy in Europe. For French President Sarkozy, the country's AAA credit rating was a source of pride. With the presidential election just 3 months away, yesterday's downgrade will have far-reaching political implications. As NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports from Paris, French officials tried to downplay the news.
Though rumors swirled all day that France was headed for the downgrade, Finance Minister François Baroin officially announced it on the nightly news. He tried to soften the blow. The United States, the world's largest economy, was downgraded over the summer, Baroin said. You have to be relative. You have to keep your cool. It's not necessary to frighten the French people about it. Out on the streets of Paris, people seem to take the news in stride. Ratings agencies are often viewed with skepticism here because of their complete failure to foresee the 2009 global financial crisis. Vincent Vigouroux says France will survive.
It's just a rating, and I'm not so worried about France's situation. It's not very perfect, but other countries are maybe worse. I think Standard & Poor's and Moody's, Fitch have not any credibility in all the judgments they made in the past.
Even though the downgrade was only one notch to AA+, it is a blow in many respects. France was a Eurozone leader coupled with Germany. Now borrowing rates between the two countries are separated by several percentage points. Many pundits commented that France had now left the Northern European club of good students to join the shirkers at the south of the class. The opposition socialists are already calling the downgrade a failure of Sarkozy's policies. The president will most certainly blame it on the socialists' objections to his reforms. Ironically, until a couple months ago, most French people didn't even know what a AAA rating was. But Sarkozy turned it into a badge of honor. He bragged about the notation in speeches and interviews like this one.
Mais le triple A, nous l'avons. Sur 27 pays européens.
The AAA, we've got it. Of Europe's 27 countries, only five have it, and France is one of them.
In the last 2 months, Sarkozy's government has been preparing for the downgrade by playing down the importance of the AAA. In a recent interview, the president said it wouldn't be good news if France lost it, but it wouldn't be cataclysmic either. Claude Veille is editor of left-leaning magazine Le Nouvel Observateur. He says Sarkozy is trying to turn France's loss of its AAA to his advantage.
From the moment it became very clear that we are going to lose this AAA, Sarkozy changed his argument. He said, the situation is so hard, so complicated, that you must trust me. I'm the only one who can run the country in this tempest.
This tempest has already swept away governments in Spain, Greece, and Italy, but Veille says in France the opposition is weak and has proposed no alternative solutions to solving the debt crisis.
As you know, French people are fed up with Sarkozy. In normal situation, he would be beaten, certainly.
Veya says that's the French paradox, that Sarkozy may be one of the only European leaders saved by losing the AAA. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.